Welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. I am Susan Thompson, your lay leader today. We are an intentionally inclusive congregation, and we welcome everyone to our church. Our membership book is open for signing today. If you have found a spiritual home here, please look for the membership table. As always, we invite everyone to enjoy refreshments and conversation in House and Hall after the service. Please join with me in affirming our mission statement, which is printed in our order of service as well as on our wall. At First UU Church of Austin, we gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice.
It is my privilege to introduce a special speaker this morning who will introduce us to and help us begin to go into the subject of immigration. Our testimonial this morning is given by James Knopp. James has been the developmental director at Gateways, American Gateways, since 2009. This organization provides legal services for more than 16,000 immigrants in need each year. Truly a phenomenal number and great service to this community. James is a native Texan and has been in the nonprofit world for some time. He's worked with advocacy and nonprofit organizations, including the ACLU of Texas and Planned Parenthood of Austin, before joining American Gateways. Could you please join me in giving a very warm welcome to James?
Good morning, and thank you. It's a privilege for me to be here with you this morning, and I felt so warmly welcomed, and so I want to say thank you very much for that. As Ed said, I work at American Gateways. This is an organization that many of you know already. I know that when we have turned to First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin for help and support, you have been there for us individually and collectively, so thank you. I wanted to tell you today about the people that we serve in our organization, and I want to tell you about one client in particular, Esther. Esther lives in Austin. She's originally from Cameroon. She met a man named Eric shortly after she came to the United States on a work visa. They became friends, and Eric helped her adjust to life in the United States. They started a relationship, and after 6 months, they were married. At first, Esther and Eric were happy together, but then Esther began to notice changes in Eric's behavior. He became jealous and aggressive. If he caught Esther talking with a neighbor or with friends, he'd curse at her and call her names. During one argument, he even threw a glass bowl at her in the kitchen, and it shattered. Around the same time, Esther found out that Eric was unfaithful. They separated for a time, and while they were separated, Eric called Esther constantly, stalked her at work, telling her that he was going to have her deported if she didn't come back to him. She was scared and confused, and ultimately, at the urging of her minister, she decided to give Eric another chance. They reconciled and had a daughter the following year. But after the reconciliation, Eric's abusive behavior continued to escalate. Esther was scared to leave because of his repeated threats to have her deported, and because if she left him, she wouldn't have any money. Of course, she was also worried about what would happen to her daughter. Wanting a better life for her daughter than for herself, Esther finally reached out for help. She contacted us at American Gateways and found out that we could file an immigration petition for her based on the abuse that she suffered through the Federal Violence Against Women Act. The VAWA law provides help for immigrants trapped in abusive relationships who are afraid of losing their legal status if they end their marriage to a citizen or legal permanent resident. Eric used the threat of losing her status to trap Esther in the abusive relationship. But the VAWA law provides a path to legal residency in the U.S., separate and apart from being in a marriage to a U.S. citizen. If Esther cooperated with law enforcement to see that Eric was held accountable as her abuser, she could take advantage of the law's visa provisions. And luckily, here in Austin, at least for now, the police and prosecutors don't generally ask about your legal status. An American Gateway's attorney was able to assist Esther to obtain her VAWA visa. She was able to obtain permanent residency less than a year after leaving Eric for good. Today, she lives and works independently with her daughter. Esther's story is important because it's not uncommon. Each year at American Gateways, we help hundreds of women and children and men in situations similar to Esther's, as do other legal service providers across Texas. I choose to do this work because I believe in human rights and justice for all people, including newcomers and immigrants. And I believe that the lack of money shouldn't keep you from receiving the law's protections. Because of the services that American Gateways provided for free, Esther was able to become an American, and her daughter is an American. In her situation, our nation delivered on its promise to be a welcoming place to newcomers and became a place where she and her daughter are able to pursue the American dream. And it's a privilege for me to be a part of this work at American Gateways and likewise to be here today to share it with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, today I venture into a very non-controversial subject called immigration. I do so with blindness. It is a hotter issue in many senses of that word in this area of the country than where I live, but it touches us all. I wish to reflect on the moral dimension of the immigration issue, not the political, not the legal, but the moral dimension. There is a distinction between the moral and legal dimensions of life that is worth noting. There are many things, for example, which might be legal, but not necessarily moral. For example, our UUA president, Reverend Peter Morales, has written the following. The forced removal of Native Americans from their land onto reservations was legal. The importation and sale of African slaves was, at a time, legal. And paralleling experiences in my own life, he writes, we had laws at one time across the South designed to prevent African American citizens from voting. Apartheid was legal in South Africa. Crucifying Jesus was legal. Burning Michael Servetus, a UU saint and martyr, so to speak, at the stake for his particular Unitarian theology was legal. So the fact that something might be legal and esteemed by the majority of the citizens and certainly seen as respectful and honorable and right does not make it, in the long view of history, moral. We as citizens naturally respect the rule of law. We are a land of laws, and accordingly, it is very important to live by them and to honor them. but the aims of morality, if it's rooted in a religious or non-religious vision of life, aims to seek, create and mold laws which approximate to a greater and greater extent that which is right and true. We are a religious community, and therefore we're called upon to look at issues through the lens of morality and conscience and ethics. This is, in a manner of speaking, our calling as an institution. And the meaning of the separation of church and state is primarily that the religious sphere will not control the political one. But this separation does not restrict religious communities such as our own in being witnesses to the moral dimension of the issues of our time. The whole point of being a religious community in the world, standing with and among other institutions of society, is we are making an attempt to let our lives be guided by our formulations of what is true and moral. And if we turn to UU principles, we see that in our second principle, as UUs, there is a commitment to affirm and promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. The mission of this congregation at the very end speaks of doing justice. So this principle, this mission, speaks volumes regarding our role vis-a-vis the issue of immigration. First of all, I believe that we must become aware and pledge ourselves to be conscious of and to renounce every form of prejudice and racism that swirls around the issue of immigration. That much, at least for me, is unambiguous. And let us not be fooled into the idea that prejudice is not lurking in and around the issue of immigration. Just this last week, Representative Virgil Peck of Kansas was asked to resign after he had said unauthorized immigrants should be shot from helicopters. Peck made this comment last week during a hearing on how to deal with the state's hog problem. After someone suggested shooting the superfluous hogs from helicopters, Peck quipped, "If shooting these immigrating hogs works, maybe we have found a solution to our illegal immigration problem." He later said that this statement was a joke and has since apologized, but advocacy groups argue that Peck should resign from his position, and their petition has asked Kansas Governor Sam Brownback and House Speaker Mike O'Neill to, quote, "call for his resignation now and hold him accountable for his hateful rhetoric." Latino and immigrant advocacy groups delivered more than 50,000 signatures to the Kansas Capitol on Friday, just this last Friday, for his resignation. The governor has called Peck's statement, quote, "completely inappropriate," but so far he has not asked for him to step down. One of the organizers of the petition behind these 50,000 signatures or more is this. He made this comment. If you listen to the remarks, he was emphatic about it. There was no sign in his comments that he was joking. It just goes to show how far extreme politicians have gone to speak about immigration, that they're just cavalier about saying someone should be shot. The undertone of racism at work, not always and everywhere, but interlaced with the debate on immigration, was quite evident to Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, the UU minister of Phoenix, Arizona, when she was arrested in July of 2010 during a march against an Arizona law, SB 1070, that targeted illegal immigrants. Here's part of what she wrote about her experience of being put in jail. Throughout our processing in the jail, we saw significant disparities in how white people and people of color were treated. Listening to politicians on the outside, it's possible to convince ourselves that people are not targeting people based on race, but inside the jail, it is impossible to deny. Anyone who was in the jail with me on these days cannot deny that racism underpins this rhetoric of fear around illegal immigration. So a renouncement of hatred and racism and an awareness that that is operative in the debate is, to my mind, the first unequivocal step. And as we begin this moral reflection regarding the issue of immigration itself, let us be clear about a number of terms that are rife in the debate. Because in anxious systems in our society is one big anxious system. In anxious system, people confuse things with each other that should not be mixed. And so it is the case in the current debate. Consider the term immigrants, used as though there is a group of people out there who are immigrants vis-a-vis us who are obviously non-immigrants. The fact is, we are all immigrants. My grandmother on my mother's side is from Copenhagen, Denmark. My grandfather on my mother's side is from Swansea, Wales. My father's father's family, going back seven generations, is from Switzerland. My grandmother on my father's side, her family, it's unknown, and the family generally is hesitant to find out exactly where they are from. But do you get the picture? Not that many years ago, my grandparents on my mother's side are both from Europe. My father, going back about seven generations, is from Europe. We all have similar stories. We are all from other places. There is no other in this community of immigrants. The question is, and what makes us different, is were we immigrants 3 years ago or 100 years ago or 200 years ago? Another aspect of this issue is the conflation and intermingling of the immigration issue and the so-called war on terror. And nowhere is the anxiety of the anxious system, which is our country, more evident than in the conflation of these two items. After 9/11, anti-terrorism enforcement and immigration enforcement virtually became the same thing. That's what anxious systems always do. They fuse things and confuse things. The number of Border Patrol agents grew after that from 3,000 to more than 9,000. At various times, more than 6,000 National Guard members have been sent to the U.S.-Mexican border to supplement the border control. And the number of officers that are in the so-called dark world, which no one knows about, is surely has rapidly increased as well. Before 9/11, illegal immigrants were released and told to return for their hearing date. Today, post 9/11, illegal aliens are held in federal detention camps until their hearings. About 31,000 non-citizens, including children, are held in immigration detention camps or places on any given day. Think about that. There are over 200 detention centers, jails, and prisons nationwide connected to this process. The anxiety around this issue of our immigration laws after 9/11 reached the climax in December of 2005 when the House of Representatives passed a bill that would redefine illegal immigrants as felons. I remember that. And I remember how quickly the community, Hispanic community, mobilized. Very quickly, they responded. On May the 1st, 2006, 600,000 people marched in Los Angeles, 400,000 marched in Chicago, and large demonstrations were held in New York and Dallas. And as a result of this pressure and other forms of pressure, there was a backing down in the House from this bill. And it failed in the Senate altogether. So, and another essential step in this debate called the immigration issues is to decouple immigration and the so-called war on terror, because their mingling and commingling has led to many types of errors. But let's talk for a moment of why people specifically from Mexico would come to this country. And it's pretty straightforward, as you know. In June of 2008, President Obama said, "For all the noise and anger that too often surrounds the immigration debate, those who come here have come here for the same reason that families have always come here, for the hope that in America they could build a better life for themselves and their families." Most Americans are in the dark and tend to think that somehow we are passive victims of an onslaught of illegal immigrants. But the truth is, the reality is that the macro economic policies that the United States has created over the last 20 years that disproportionately benefit the wealthy have helped to create economic hardship in Mexico, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, among other places, that drive people out of their country to survive. Consider just one tiny aspect of this very complex issue. A little-known part of the NAFTA agreement required Mexico to change a particular law. A law that had allowed for generations the existence of large areas of land owned communally for generations. Now, under the law, within that NAFTA, it could be bought by the wealthy and by corporations. This is one aspect of NAFTA alone that led to thousands upon thousands of people fleeing Mexico. The issue of immigration, as we know it today, would not exist without this context of NAFTA and other economic policies. The immigration issue needs to be seen in the context of these economic policies that affect all Americans, the people in Mexico, the people throughout the world. Let's talk for a moment about the actual cost of illegal immigrants. In 2006, a report given by your own state's comptroller, then comptroller, Carolyn Keaton Strayhorn, analyzed the economic impact of immigration on Texas. And the report found that the estimated 1.4 million illegal immigrants in Texas generated $17.7 billion in gross state product. Gross state product means their total purchase of goods and services, the use of their economic resources to buy things and to buy services. They also produced $1.58 billion in state revenue, mostly from sales tax and other fees. According to the same report, illegal immigrants received $1.16 billion in state services, such as education. Local governments also spent an additional $1.44 billion in uncompensated health care costs and local law enforcement costs not paid for by the state. The bottom line is, if you look at those figures, illegal immigrants are net contributors to the economic well-being of the state. Some say they don't pay federal taxes, and that is where they are truly hurting the economy. But that is related to the fact that they're considered illegals. So it's a vicious cycle. All indications are that immigrants are net contributors to the economic well-being of their community. This too needs to be a part of the debate. But let's consider this issue within a larger framework, the perspective of demographics, because demographic trends are a game changer for this whole debate and make most of what we do and say about this issue inadequate and behind the times. Consider this. In the year 2050, one in five Americans will be a member of a family which belongs in the category of recent immigrant, where recent means no more than three generations from immigration. The Latino population will triple in size to 30% of the U.S. population. The percentage of African Americans will increase slightly. The proportion of Asian Americans will almost double. Meanwhile, the non-Latino white American group, currently 75% of the population, will fall to 46% by 2050. So in less than 40 years, the makeup of society will be composed in ways that make our current debate and arguments inadequate and out of touch. Well, in closing, let me share a couple of things. I don't have all the answers, although I always like to think that I might. I do not pretend to be an expert on the multifaceted dimensions of the subject. That is not my place and role, but it is my role to ask the question, what might we do if we could consider the immigration issue in a non-anxious way? What would happen if we could consider the immigration issue detangled and detached from the anxious way in which it is currently debated? What might happen if we allowed the course of our debate to be guided by our UU principles? What might happen if we let our debate and our actions be led by our belief in the worth and dignity of all persons? What if we truly tried to align how we see this debate with our value and principle of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations? At the same time, what would happen if we knew and acknowledged the true reality that change is not only coming, change is not only evolving in front of our eyes, change is here, and we are blind if we do not see it. It is not necessary to be afraid of change. You know, sometimes in my work as a minister, I find myself working with people and suggesting a change and people becoming uncomfortable with that. I know that's never happened to you. I know that's never happened at this church. But it sometimes happens that change, though it is inevitable, can be fought against. But what would happen if we opened ourselves up to the possibility that, yes, change is happening and that we need to adjust to it and open up to ways that can make it a truly happy change? The issue of immigration, from my eyes as a UU minister, is ultimately not about public policy. It is about the human condition, the fear of the other, the never-ending operations of racism and wanting to divide the world into us and them. And the immigration issue is, in fact, a historic conflict between inclusion and exclusion, between the play of fear and hope, between a clinging to a vanishing past and a hesitancy to be open to what might be a very creative weaving and dancing with the changes that are afoot. I invite you to join a group of people in this church who are engaged and involved and will continue to be so in this very important issue. Our lay leader for today, Susan Thompson, will tell us a little more about this group later. And also, if you feel moved to express yourself on the immigration issue, I encourage you to visit the social action table that will be manned or personed by Karina. Karina, could you hold up your hand? And she will lead you into ways in which you can let your voice be heard through petition on this issue. I close with these remarks written by a poet long ago. He said, "If I have to belong to some tribe, let us make it a large tribe. Make it a strong tribe, one in which nobody is left out, in which everybody, for once and for all, has their place." May it be so. Amen. I share with you this benediction. May an awareness of the gifts of life and the preciousness of each moment be in us and guide us. May the memories we gather here give us hope for our lives and for our future. May the love that we feel here bring strength to our hearts and courage to our minds as we let our principles guide our deeds. And may always the peace that is beyond all understanding be in us until we meet again. Amen.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.